Revelation 17, what an exciting end. All of the history of the world puzzling over the problem of evil. Why does bad, you've heard that before, haven't you? Why do bad things happen to good people? You know, the premise of the question is wrong. Bad things sometimes are bad when God turns them around, right? And good people, there are no good people. So you all hopefully know that by now. Biblically speaking, that is, we're all good, of course, humanly speaking, okay? Why doesn't God do something? Well, he will, and we have it written right here in the last book of the Bible, and it's fitting that it is the last book. It's called the Apocalypse, and Apocalypse, if you remember, means God entering into history. When he enters into history, how do you describe it? Except everything's turned upside down, and it uses language that is odd, uses figurative language heavily. There's angels involved and all kinds of things involved, upheaval. Now, if we go all the way back to Genesis 11, we will find that the history of the world, Genesis 11 is the last little recorded of what you call primeval, before there was history. That's what that means. Primeval time, I guess that's redundant, but anyway. And we have the rebellion at Babylon. And rebellion is nothing new for the world. It started in Genesis 3. And so what happens here, if you look at this, we can see the continuity of the entire Bible. It starts with, and that's where we're heading now in chapter 17 and 18 in Revelation. It starts with a world rebelling against God in Babylon, and it ends with Babylon being judged in Revelation 17 and 18. So it's all just held together. Well, right here in Genesis 11, starting in verse 1, the whole world... That means everything, right? The whole world had one language and a common speech. As men moved eastward, in other words, away from the garden in that area, as men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar, which literally is Babylon, and they settled there. They said to each other, "Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They used brick instead of stone and tar for mortar. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens." You've often heard of the Tower of Babylon. "So we may make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the earth." So in other words, these are people that are saying, we're going to do this because we're our own gods. And now in verse 5, the Lord came down to see the city and the tower that the men were building. Of course, he doesn't need to do that. He already knows what's up, but this is so we can see what's going on. Verse 6, the Lord said, "It is if as one people speaking the same language they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them." In other words, it'll just keep going on forever, this rebellion. We got to put a stop to it. Verse 7, "Come, let us go down and confuse..." Now, they're using that language. "Come, let us..." And this is God saying it. "Now, come, let us go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other." He's going to pull the plug on their plans. They won't be able to talk to each other. Verse 8. "So the Lord scattered them from there over all the earth." How did he do it? He didn't tell them to take off. People didn't even know why they suddenly scattered. All of a sudden they couldn't understand each other and the people groups just started. And that was God's plan. He's told them, go and be fruitful and multiply and cover the earth, but they wouldn't do it. Now they're going to do it. That's his plan. So verse 8, "So the Lord scattered them from there all over the earth, and they stopped building the city." Put a stop to it. That's why it's called Babel. In Hebrew, that means a word that cannot be understood. Babel. It even means that in English a little bit. Isn't that interesting? "Because there the Lord confused the language of the whole world." It was a miracle. All of a sudden they couldn't talk to each other. "From there, the Lord," again, it repeats this, "the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth." Let's go to Acts chapter 17. A different kind of gathering is going on. Start in Acts 2. In Genesis 11, he spread them out. Now in Acts 2, he's joining them all together again, trying to call people back through in the gospel. Now here's what it says in Acts 17, just to put a little extra thought into what happened. Verse 24, Acts 17, verse 24. Paul is trying to preach to the men of Athens, and they aren't quite getting it because they're They don't understand who made the universe. They think it just popped into existence or the gods made it. But he's explaining what happened. And we're picking up right here in verse 24. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth. In other words, he's in charge of everything. Don't you know that? And he doesn't live in temples made by hands. He doesn't need a temple. All these little shrines that are all over the place. Verse 25. And he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything, because he himself gives all men life and breath and everything else. Verse 26, from one man he made every nation of men that they should inhabit the whole earth. And he determined the time set for them and the exact places where they should live. Verse 27, God did this. Now that kind of sounds similar to Genesis 11, doesn't it? Although we're getting some more reason behind it. Now, verse 27, God did this so that men would seek him. Remember, if they're all on their own building the tower, they're not going to seek God. In fact, they weren't seeking him at all. They're in rebellion. But now they're going to be needy. Oh, help me, somebody. Is there a God? Help me. Now you can see the reason why he did this. Verse 27, God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he's not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as some of your own prophets. We are his offspring. Basically, you can see that Adam and Eve rebelled, and God still graciously covered them and protected them. Now here in the tower, the people rebel, and God still graciously sent them out so that they might seek him. So there's mercy in all of this. People have often said, and somebody said, you know, the New Testament is hidden in the Old, and in the Old is open in the New. And the only way God is going to fix all this rebellion and all the stuff that's gone on, the only way it's going to be fixed is through the Messiah. Through the Messiah. He's the only one that can stop the rebellion. Haven't we all stopped rebelling? Yeah, I mean, we just don't want to anymore. The rest of the world, they're on their own. They're the Babylon, you might say, as we will see tonight. So let's look at the world system is getting introduced. The first two verses of Revelation 17. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits on many waters. Verse 2. With her, the kings of the earth committed adultery with the inhabitants of the earth, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries. It doesn't sound too good. Now, you have to realize, of course, we don't have a problem with this. It's figurative language, right? I mean, we don't have a problem understanding this is figurative language. And now I'm just going to do a little repeat of what I've said before a couple times, just so we get this. If we took this literally, I mean woodenly literal, it wouldn't make any sense. A great prostitute, how great, how important, how successful must she be? And she has a worldwide brothel. She's so important. And she probably looked a little seedy standing in a window luring passersby. No, doesn't mean that at all. And she's not sitting in a window anyway. She's really sitting on many waters, perhaps a bathtub or a bunch of rivers or maybe a case of water bottles. I don't know. The kings of the earth committed adultery with her. Imagine the pomp and circumstance of all the kings coming, laying down their crowns, all their helpers, while they laying aside their robes. And they committed adultery. All the king's wives are waiting for them with frying pans, you know, whack them on the head when they got home for misbehaving. And the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries. And that has to be some wine to get everyone in the world, including infants. Everyone, the whole world is drunk and intoxicated. So drunk that no one can drive a car or operate heavy machinery. That's it. It's over. You will hear people always say, you got to take the Bible literally. And I had somebody send a message to me that I wasn't taking the Bible literally, not because of this Bible study. And I don't ever argue with people. I just say, oh, I'm going to do my best. It doesn't work arguing. But I realized, and I didn't want to give them a lecture on what it means to take the Bible literally, but I actually agreed with them. I do take the Bible literally, but as all of us do, we must define literal. In other words, we all do it without even, we all use language literally. We use the common rules of language, don't we? The sun sets. That's figurative. You know anything about astronomy? The sun isn't setting. It's 90 how many million miles away, and it's just kind of going around, and it just disappeared. It's not setting. You know what I mean? So we have to allow that same freedom and reality in the Bible to be used. Or I got a ton of weight on my shoulders. You don't see the, you know, I'd be dead if I did. That's 2,000 pounds. But in other words, I'm worried about. So that's figurative language. We use it all the time. We have to allow that in the Bible and be careful to interpret things literally when they should be literally meaning literal, one-to-one correspondence, you might say, and when something is figuratively because there's no other way to describe it. And we use figurative language constantly. So we have to be aware of that. So the apocalyptic literature is full of figurative language. And so some people misuse it. Well, let's see what the world system, it's really talking about the world system. The woman in this is the world system. All the way to the end, in verse 18, we're told. It's neat that the angel is describing all this for us. Verse 18, the woman you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth. Now, the great woman at John's writing had to have been Rome. They were ruling things, and wasn't the Roman Catholic Church, because it didn't even exist then. The second great awakening didn't happen until the 1500s, middle 1500s for the Roman Catholic Church. Now, it was starting around 500 AD it started, but definitely not at 90 or 70 AD. So it's Rome, and Rome really represents the world system. Who's ever in charge at the time? And then it was Rome. So he's going to use these allusions toward Rome. So the woman is the world system, and this world system gives birth to false religions constantly, which is not faithful to the revelation that God has given. So they're unfaithful, hence spiritual adultery. It's unfaithful. So the world system then also is a seductress, you know, wooing people in to believe this and believe that. I mean, all we have to do is watch the news. If you ever watch somebody on the network news or, you know, talk about Christianity, they always get it wrong. I can't believe it. When are they going to get somebody that really knows something about the Bible that you can be trusted to speak something? I wish I could record some of the stuff I've seen just to save it as examples, but it's just outrageous, and I'm sure you all know what I'm talking about. So the ultimate spiritual adultery is false worship. And really, that's really the, if not the major, one of the major themes in the book of Revelation, true worship versus false worship. And everything's going to end up at the feet of Jesus, true worship or false worship. So the waters, the waters, then, we're told in verse 15 what the waters are. The waters represent, it says, the angel said to me in verse 15, the waters you saw where the prostitute sits are the peoples, multitudes. Notice these are all plurals. Nations, languages. In other words, all the culture, everything out there. That's the waters. The sea of humanity tossed back and forth by the wind and waves of doctrine. The great prostitute rules and reigns over these people, intoxicating them, poisoning them with false religion. The kings of the earth commit adultery with her. The intoxication spreads. I think it was last week I mentioned the Romans 12. After 11 chapters in the book of Romans, laying down the foundation of who we are in Christ, it's not until chapter 12 where Paul tells us how we're supposed to live. First, worship has to be established in the right relationship with Christ. Then in chapter 12, now, in view of God's mercy, in other words, because of who you are, do not any longer be conformed to the image of this world. The prostitute is trying to woo you in to conform to her, if I can use that illustration, image, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, which is your reasonable act of worship, says there in Romans 12. Worship is putting God first. True worship. So, oftentimes a woman is used, I'm sorry for that illustration, the Jezebel influence in chapter 2 of Revelation, we read about her, the defiling principle. Jezebel is one way of describing the world system. Babylon is another way. The woman is another way. So there's a spiritual battle going on this world knows nothing about. I mean, I put some of those in your notes, 2 Corinthians 4:4, Satan is the god of this world, and he has blinded the eyes of unbelievers so they won't come to the knowledge of the truth. They don't even know that. That's why the network news can't get it. They never will. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 18, all the way to the end of chapter 2, those two chapters, just nothing but that, how they can't get it without being born again. Galatians 1, 4, this is a present evil age. And this is an evil age. Remember when God created time when sin entered into the world. Boom, the evil age started. And then it's going to end. Remember that little timeline? It was real complicated. Just had a beginning and ending, just straight line. That's time that we live in, and that's the evil age that we live in. Ephesians 2:2, the whole world is under the sway of the evil one. The world doesn't know this. Remember Revelation 12, verse 9, the job description of Satan is to deceive the whole world and lead them astray. Ephesians 6:12, this is a spiritual battle. It's a miracle to get saved. It's the greatest miracle in the world. We need more of that. So sometimes I hear people laugh. You know, they like to laugh at us. We can laugh at them. Anyway, talk about, we think there's a conspiracy out there to get Christians. There really is no conspiracy. The world is just acting the only way they know how. I mean, this is how the world acts. So they don't even have to conspire. It's just natural. But underneath it, invisibly, there is a conspiracy of the evil one. Now, you can't tell people that because they... think you're crazy or not, but we've been called out of the world, right, as believers, and we don't belong to it. He has no foothold in us whatsoever, the enemy, so we don't have to worry. But this prostitute will be punished. It's a way of saying the end is coming. The end is coming. False worship will be done away with. So the world doesn't know that. The world doesn't want to hear that message. Instead, they have a yin and a yang, you know, I forgot what they call that. There's a word for it. The balance of good and evil, you know, just kind of working each other, or they coexist, you know. Can't we just all get along, Rodney King? What's the answer to all those? It's just not going to work. There is no balance of good and evil. This whole society is in turmoil. There's no United Nation, no peace accords, no peace treaties, no alliances. Nothing is going to work. There's no evolving to correctness. There's no scientific solutions. There's no economic fix. There's only one fix. Justice. God's justice, right? And what does justice mean? Making things right. So he made things right through the cross. Now just get into that, we're telling the world. Get out of the world and he will put you in position under Christ, in Christ. But eventually that's in the apocalypse that we're studying right now, that's the big fix. That's when finally God just calls time. It's over. He's going to bring justice on earth. Right now we have time. We have time. 2 Peter 3:9, God is not slow in keeping his promise. As some understand slowness, it has nothing to do with speed. It has to do with love because he wants everyone to be saved. Wow. Anyway, so now let's look at the world system revealed, verse 3 to verse 6. Then the angel carried me away. Now, John, he's had a wild ride. I mean, we're still five chapters to go or so. He has seen so much. I'm surprised he could survive after writing this all the stuff he went through. But in some kind of angelic vision, a typical and apocalyptic, if you could read the book of Zechariah, the angels all involved, talking to him and showing him stuff. Same thing here, because it's an apocalyptic writing. Verse 3, the angel carried me away in the spirit into a desert. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had seven heads and ten horns. Verse 4, the woman was dressed in purple and scarlet and was glittering with gold, precious stones and pearls. She had a golden cup in her hand filled with abominable things and the filth of her adulteries. The title was written on her forehead, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and of the abominations of the earth. Verse 6, I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints. In other words, she's a murderer. She likes to kill people. She's drunk. She's had her fill. She can't kill anymore. The blood of those who bore the testimony to Jesus. Now, when John was writing this, you know, Nero was the king. And finally, you know, Paul was killed there by Nero just about a year before Nero died. And pretty soon they started throwing Christians to the lions, and he had to have a worship certificate, remember all that? And killing went on for about 300 years until Constantine put a stop to it, at least for a while anyway. Verse 3, the angel carried me away into the desert, far away from the world, where he can get a look at things from a perspective without the world bugging him. I don't know, he's just he had to get a distance away. He was on leave from the world, you might say. a woman was sitting on a scarlet beast covered with blasphemous names. Couldn't get a more uglier picture of somebody, especially from God's perspective. You ever see some of the shows on TV and stuff? You go, wince, and they're perpetrating this stuff on our kids and on our... I can't even watch MTV anymore. You have to monitor it now, and I used to get in trouble for monitoring it for my kids. My family was liberal, and they didn't understand it. Of course, they weren't born again, didn't understand it, but my extended family, that is. But ugliness of it all, and blasphemous name covered, it means he's immersed in blasphemy, being carried and inspiring in cahoots with the world system. They're riding on this together, this beast and the woman. So there is a conspiracy, you might say, invisibly speaking. Verse 4, the woman was dressed in purple and scarlet. In other words, to the world, this is probably one of those models. I don't know, just everything's perfect. They didn't have touch-up stuff back then. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet, with glittering with gold, precious stones and pearls. She held a golden cup in her hand. Everything's beautiful until you read the next line. What was in that cup? It was abominable, filled with abominable things. An abomination is the worst description that God gives in his word, abominable. The filth of her adulteries. She's partaking, drinking in this cup, essentially. Dressed in the richest affair, the world will love this stuff. The attraction of the world system. Golden on the outside, but what's on the inside? Filth and rot. So the faithfulness to the Lord is often spoken of in terms of marriage, and marriage is the picture of faithfulness. And the world time will end in a marriage, the wedding supper of the Lamb. God's got this whole idea of faithfulness locked into our hearts, and he wants us to be faithful to him. We are warned so many times in Scripture. I just have a few in your notes here. I know we've seen them all millions of times, but it's good to review. John 15, Jesus goes into great detail, almost the whole chapter, talking about the difference between the world and us. And he says some things that the world doesn't want to hear. John 15, verse 18. Whenever the world talks about Jesus, they never talk about what Jesus says or who he really is. It's some made-up Jesus, maybe a dashboard glow-in-the-dark plastic Jesus, something that in their own image. But listen to what he says about the world right here in John 15, verse 18. If the world hates you, keep in mind that it hated me first. We don't hate you, Jesus, but we'd rather have Barabbas come down than you. They don't understand reality. Verse 19, if you belong to the world, it would love you as its own. As it is, you do not belong to the world. I have chosen you out of the world. That's why the world hates you. We all should remember that. We don't belong to the world anymore. That's why we are told to not copy the world. We don't belong to the world anymore. That's why the world hates us. Verse 20, remember the words I spoke to you? No servant is greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you also. If they obeyed my teaching, they will obey yours also. In other words, they will fall into line, not 100% like robots, but they'll fall into the basic teaching of the church. 21, they will treat you this way because of my name. In other words, who I stand for. That's what name means, all of his authority. For they do not know the one who sent me. What a picture. What a picture of the battle that Jesus describes. Now, if you go all the way to James, which is just after the book of Hebrews, I think. Way back there. Yeah, there it is. 4:4. It's easy to remember. It's 4:4. James says something very straightforward. And you adulterous people. He's talking about people who are balancing back and forth between being a true believer and not being a true believer. He says, you adulterous people. Notice they use the word adultery in a spiritual sense. It's being unfaithful. James 4:4, you adulterous people, don't you know that friendship with the world is hatred toward God? Now, that doesn't mean we're not for the green and don't want to save the whatever animal happens to need to be saved. No, it's the world's system, the world's way of thinking, because there's a God of this world. That's what we're talking about here. Not the physical world. He's talking about the spiritual world, the, that puts thoughts in our heads, that rides the beast and wants us all to be intoxicated by the wine of adulteries. You adulterous people, don't you know that friendship with the world is hatred toward God? Anyone who chooses to be a friend of the world becomes an enemy of God. Now, you're in James, just go a few pages back to 1 John, and it gets even more, and very appropriately, John, this is one of his major themes in everything he writes, but he says this in 1 John, his first letter, 1 John chapter 2, verse 15, "Do not love the world." Now, wait a minute, don't we read in John 3:16, "God so loved the world"? So I hope you can know by this, there's two different meanings of the word world. God so loved the people of the world. That's what that means. Okay. You know, you may have to have a conversation with somebody out in the street or somewhere, so you have to be able to show them this, because they like to point fingers at the Bible because they don't read it correctly. Don't love the world. It's talking about the world system or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Because obviously we will begin to divorce ourselves from the things that the world cares about. Verse 16, "For everything in the world," now he's going to name really the three temptations from the Garden of Eden in a different little light here. "The cravings of sinful man," that's the flesh. I forgot what it was in the Garden of Eden. "The lust of," to eat the fruit. "Or the lust of the eyes." It looks good for eating. She saw the fruit. "And the boasting of what he has and does." In other words, you will be like God. So those three categories are right there. "Comes not from the Father, but from the world." The world and its desires pass away, as we are reading right now. "But the man who does the will of God lives forever." So there's another little tidbit for us. Just the three little verses that kind of speak to this idea of the world is in harlotry against God, and we need to understand that. Now back to Revelation 17, verse 5. "Now there is a title on her forehead, mystery," because not everybody will get this. It's a mystery to the world. All the evil in the world is a mystery to the world. Yeah, we can fix this. We'll educate ourselves out of it. That's it. Well, how long have we been trying? It's been a long time. And once you're saved a while, you realize the source of that is we must be born again. Now I can see what's going on. So the title is written on her forehead, mystery, the Babylon the Great, the mother or the source of all false religions, all prostitutes, and of the abominations of the earth. Again, we have the mystery of lawlessness. I think it was 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 talks about the mystery of lawlessness. What is wrong with this earth? Now, a good place to look is Romans 8. Romans chapter 8. Paul answers this question in Romans 8, verse 18. Now, really, when we're in chapter 8 in Romans, we're at the grand crescendo of the explanation of the gospel. He's gone through 8 chapters, and now the horns are honking, but he has to kind of set it into context here. So he starts in verse 18, "I consider that our present sufferings," and there will be some in this world, "are not worth comparing to the glory that will be revealed in us," talking about the end of the age. Because right now in verse 19, "creation waits in eager expectations for the sons of God to be revealed." In other words, the end of the age. So all of creation, this is figurative language, of course, the trees aren't really waiting, but in God's point of view, yes, they are waiting in a sense, right? They're waiting for the end of the age where we can be restored, because there's hurricanes and tornadoes and disease and sickness and the world is in terrible shape. Verse 20, "for creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected." That's Adam and Eve. They brought a curse onto this earth in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. Verse 22, "we know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to this present time." It's like, oh, it's in travail. When is the end going to come? It's just a pictorial way of saying even nature just wants the second coming and get this over with. But we got to get some more born again into the kingdom. So there's this travail, this birth that must take place. We got to get more saved somehow. So this world is subjected to sin, and this Roman, I'm sure there was Roman influence here, because the Roman emperors would wear these headdresses, and they were considered gods, starting with Caesar. Well, when Caesar started, he did such a good job, he was supposed to stop being Caesar, which wasn't his real name. Caesar means king or god, like Tsar, Caesar. But they named him that. No, you just keep ruling because you're doing such a good job. It's kind of like letting the responsibility in the, for what they call those people, like not the cabinet, but the, what do they call those people? No, all the people that are around Caesar when Rome was, yeah, the Senate. Finally, he took all the power, because that's what humans do. He took all the power from the Senate, and they pretty soon became nobodies, and they drifted off. Now we've got one ruler, the king, and he became a god. All the Caesars did, and after Caesar, Augustus. And so he had on his hat, God of God, King of Kings, and they'd put coins out. They'd show the goddess Roma and seven hills on these coins, and Caesar on top of it all, you know, with his crown on. Anyway, you can go on the internet, you can look at some of this stuff and see it's archaeology that they found. So maybe that's the idea of the hat thing in this little illustration. There's so much in this world that is considered, I hope I'm not beating this to death, but it's considered good that isn't. And the thing that, one of the things that bugs me, I know it bugs you, is the Las Vegas ads. It's going to stay in Las Vegas. If that isn't a picture of the folly of the world system, that's the beast, or that's the woman riding the beast. You can do whatever you want in Las Vegas. Well, first of all, it's far away. It's in the middle of the desert. No one's going to, you know, and it's all probably in buildings, and no one's going to see it. And we're supposed to do this because everybody's doing it. That's the way the world operates. I've been to Las Vegas a few times. I wouldn't go to any of those places. I just only went there because of a family need. And I would tell you, I didn't like it there. The lying, the cheating, the gambling, the carousing, it's all going to stay in Vegas. And they mock us for, as the Bible's full of myths. That's a myth. Because whatever people do, it goes with them. The lying, the cheating, and the character of the person, wherever they travel, there it goes. Oh, I did this in Vegas, I'm going to do it here too. So it does travel wherever they go. Ethical standards, once you drop them, they don't just stay in that Vegas place. They go everywhere. So that's really the world system in a good picture of it. So verse 6, back to Revelation 17. I saw the woman who was drunk on the blood of the saints. She has had her fill. She's out of her mind. Of all the people that should die, it should not be the saints. You're talking about somebody holy. That's who we are. We're saints. We're holy, called apart. We belong to the Lord. Here is what caused them their death. Their testimony about Jesus. Remember that little certificate of worship? If they would worship Caesar and call him God, they would get a certificate of worship and they'd be off the hook. But some would say, no, I just can't do that. And then they get thrown to the lions or they get arrested. Who knows what would happen to them? Just bad things would happen to them. So then John says, when I saw her, I was greatly astonished. Of course, that's just something to get our attention too. This is something else. Why are you astonished? Essentially, this evil empire is going to end. We're already told that anyway. Verse 8, I believe it says it's going to end. But what's so bad about the testimony of Jesus? I know I've said this before, and forgive me for saying it, but it should be on the headlines of every paper. The gospel message is the only thing that can cure anything. Put marriages back together, put families back together. It can make people obey the law all from the inside without even one law. That's why we have so many laws that are killing us today, because the way things are going. But here we've got the only fix, and the world wants to reject it. And it's going on right now. I hope it doesn't continue to go in our nation. So now, the world system is going to be judged. Verse 7, Revelation 17. Verse 7, then the angel said to me, why are you astonished? I will explain to you the mystery of the woman and of the beast she rides, which has seven heads and 10 horns. The beast which you saw once was, now is not, and will come out of the abyss and then go to destruction. I mean, it's very simple. And also it's a little mocking God's, they're counter-mocking God's name, because the beast would take that same name, who was and is to come. Now that they're mocking, the angel's mocking the beast. Verse 8, the beast which you saw, which was, which is not, and which will come out of the abyss, will go down to destruction. The inhabitants of the earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the creation of the world will be astonished when they see the beast, because he once was, now is not, and yet will come. Verse 9, this calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven hills on which the woman sits. And there are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, the other has not yet come. But when he does come, he must remain for a little while. Verse 11, the beast who once was and now is not is an eighth king who belongs to the seven and is going to his destruction. It's hard to figure all that out, isn't it? Verse 12, the ten horns you saw are ten kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but who for 1 hour will receive authority as kings along with the beast. Verse 13, they have one purpose and will give their power and authority to the beast. They will make war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will overcome them because he is the Lord of lords and the King of kings. With him will be his called, that's us, chosen and faithful followers. We don't belong to the world anymore, remember? Verse 15, then the angel said to me, the waters you saw where the prostitute sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages. Verse 16, the beast and the ten horns you saw hate the prostitute. They will bring her to ruin and leave her naked, and they will eat her flesh and burn her with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to accomplish his purpose by agreeing to give the beast their power to rule until God's words are fulfilled. Remember, he's in charge. When he says it, it's going to happen. Verse 18, the woman you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth. Why so astonished? God knows all about this, he's saying. Again, the explanation in verse 8 is he's just going to come out from the abyss and he's going to be destroyed. It's a no-brainer for God. The inhabitants of the earth are going to be just astonished. We would be horrified if we were seeing it, but they're going to be astonished. It's amazing. Look, because the world loves leaders. Look, lead us, because we don't want to lead ourselves. The world system esteems the wrong people. The greatest example is let Barnabas go free. Crucify Jesus. No, we worship Caesar. They even said that. It just goes on and on. We want to rule, not God. Verse 9, it calls for wisdom. Rome is often called the city on seven hills. It could be referring to Rome. Ultimately, it's referring to the world system again. I know there's people that get the details pretty specific. That's fine with me if they want to do that. I just can't do that. So I just say it just represents the world system. Verse 10, there are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one. The other has yet to come. But when he does come, he must remain for a little while. Again, these rulers, so many have passed. And the Caesars, you can't really make sense of them. In fact, after Nero died, there was three in 1 year, that same year, because they'd kill him. That's the way it was. It was wild back then. I think it was Vespasian came after those three, and he got everything. It's kind of like the revival of the Roman Empire. He finally got order back in. But so many kings, Caesars flying around. You can look at any book. Every system's going to be different. So I'm not going that way either. So I hope you don't mind. But basically, the whole idea is they're going to rule for a short time. It's not going to be forever. Verse 12, the ten horns you saw are ten kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but who for 1 hour will receive authority. In other words, just for a very short time. And there's ten, and people have tried to come up with what those ten mean. I remember when I was first a Christian, it was the ten-nation confederacy that started in Europe. But I think there's 17 or 18, I don't know how many, 20 in there now, I don't know. So I don't know if it's that. I mean, you could come up with... But I really don't know what good it does to do that, try and figure out what it is. I'd rather know the basics, the fact that 10 also is a number of completion, of finality. Finally, the nations will gather together, and they're going to rebel against God, the last final battle. Verse 13, they will have one purpose and will give their power and authority to the beast. So they're going to give up all these nations. They're really not kings. They're sort of puppet kings, and they're going to have all these little... Whatever authority they have, they're going to just put it on one person or one leader or one nation. One authority is going to rule the world, basically. Then in verse 14, here's what will happen. So the world will be sold out, all out, out and out, down and out in rebellion, and all the leadership in the whole world. We don't see that yet, but we may see it one day. Hopefully we won't be here. Verse 14, they will make war against the Lamb. Now that's not a wise thing to do. They're going to make war. That's how smart they are. I know. Let's see. Now, they don't think this way, but There's the only solution in the universe that can fix anything. I know, let's go to war and destroy him. Yeah. I mean, that's like attacking God. I know, let's attack God. They will make war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will overcome them. Why? What's his name? The Lord of Lords. There's no Lord higher than him. And King of Kings. There's no King higher. In other words, he's sovereign. He is the Lord of Lords. And then guess who's with him? His called. Where are we called from? The world. Remember the name for the church? Ecclesia. Ek for ex. Exit. Kaleo for called. We're called out. Ecclesia. We're the called out ones. So we're called out of the world. Look at that. I love these titles. This is talking about you and me. We're called. We're chosen. We're the chosen people. And we're faithful followers of the Lamb. I know we can take that Lamb. We can beat him, the world says. I think it's not going to work. Verse 15, the angel said to me, the waters you saw are the prostitutes, are the people. So the prostitutes ruling all those peoples and making them do all kinds of weird things. Isaiah 17, verse 12, we get a kind of a similar illustration of water symbolizing people. Isaiah 17, verse 12, oh, the raging of many nations, they rage like the raging sea, like a torrent. Oh, the uproar of the peoples, they roar like the roaring of great waters. It's just tumult, all unorganized, chaos like Genesis chapter 1, there's chaos. Now, there's chaos in our lives until we are born again, then God speaks order. We aren't like the sea. We have order in our lives now. He speaks that into our lives. Verse 16, the beast and the ten horns will hate the prostitute. Wait a minute, there's going to be giant rebellion. I thought they're like this. No, because he's a liar, right? He's a liar and the father of lies, and his job description is to kill, steal, and destroy. He's used the world as far as he can use it. Now he's going to destroy everything. Deceive. I heard a Satanist call in a Christian radio show. I don't know why he would. And you Christians have to wait for your reward. We get ours now. Talk about deception. What reward? It's deception he's getting. At the end, it's just going to be weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth. Oops, we followed the wrong person. The real reality show is here in this book, The End of the Age. So verse 17, listen to this, how powerful God is. God has put it into their hearts to accomplish his purpose by agreeing to give the beast their power to rule until God's words are fulfilled. So it's God's behind. Remember Acts 17, all the people were on the Tower of Babel, he confused their languages. They thought, they didn't know what was up. God's behind it all. Now God's also behind this. This rebellion, this giant thing that's going on is all God. God is bringing the world to its end. One purpose, to bring everything to the feet of Jesus. This false idea, this counterfeit king, the ultimate delusion of the world that we are gods and we are kings will be crushed at the end. So Jesus is the King of Kings. Now, verse 18, it ends like this. The woman you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth. Isn't it interesting that at the end of chapter 6 in Revelation, it talks about the rich and poor, the kings, the princes, the most powerful people, one day will only have one thing to say, hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. From the wrath of the Lamb. I didn't know Jesus had wrath. No, there's justice. That's what it means. Justice has arrived. There's nothing more sterner than 100% holy, pure justice. Nothing more strict, nothing more sanitized and perfect than justice. That's why it's so scary. We have the Lord's Prayer, Lord, let your will be done on earth as it is, because it's not being done on earth right now. Well, this, it will be, and it'll be too late. There won't be any more Lord's Prayer. I hope we understand all of this more. I hope 17 was okay. If you get the kind of the big picture of this, Genesis 1, we started out with heaven and earth created, and God saw all that he made, and it was good. Then Genesis chapter 2, it speaks of a garden with God's pure bride, you know, Adam and Eve there. And then chapter 3, creation is vandalized, the whole earth groans. So now what started as a pure bride in a garden ends in a degenerated, abominable harlot in the wilderness. But all that is going to be brought back. All the purity will be brought back at the end. In the book of Revelation, the bride is restored to the rightful place. And we'll have a faithful marriage of the Lamb, like it should be, restored when justice finally hits history at the end. Let's bow our heads in prayer. Father, we thank you for your word, and there's so much more that can be said and added. And as we do study, and let us just always keep the big picture in mind as we do, and enjoy maybe the other little things, the secondary issues, but let us keep the big picture in mind and know that we belong to you. We're called out of this world. We are the chosen, and we are your faithful followers. We thank you in the name of Jesus. Amen. God bless you all.